Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our first guest is the Gloucester Police Chief, John McCarthy. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here.
Listen, I know all about you, having grown up with you, but for the benefit of our listening audience, if you could just tell us about yourself. We ask folks when they first come on, give us your bio, and we'll go from there.
Well, grown up my whole life in Gloucester. Gloucester High School graduate, have worked for the city of Gloucester since I was 14 years old. Started out on the police boat working for Action Inc. Had a neighborhood work program during the summer, and I was lucky enough to work all through high school summers on the police boat. And when I graduated from high school, I was put on as a deputy harbor master. Back then, the police ran the harbor master's department. Took the police exam. Went on the police department in 1980. And I'm still here.
Well, good. Now you mentioned you were on the police board. Who was was it Keith Trefry, or was that Lindbergh that was the assistant harbor master at the time when you were on the boat?
They were both there then. Charlie Lindbergh would work weekends, but Keith was the main guy. He's who I worked with most of the time. He was great to me, he was
They were both great guys. Yeah, I remember. What was that experience like for you, and how did that get you interested in law enforcement, or were other things along the way?
I'd say that was pretty much it. I mean, I worked 40 hours a week, on the boat. I love boats and learned to love law enforcement. So
yeah. So you came on the force in 1980. It's 2017. How much has it changed since when you started?
Quite a bit. When I started, we'd do our reports on 6x8 pieces of paper with no lines on them. Believe it or not, the first one I think I did was it had a header on the top of it, two chief coil. So
okay, wow, yeah, that's going back. And what it's changed a lot. I know things have become very computerized now. How does that help you, and how does that what does that do for law enforcement in general?
I think it's made it a lot better. Obviously, the computerization of records are at our fingertips now. There's workstations just about everywhere you can look in this police station. There are workstations. Anybody needing records, a guy makes a car stop out on the street. Within seconds we can tell him, if he's dealing with a bad guy, that's someone that's been aggressive to law enforcement in the past. We pull his record up right on our desktop, or he can pull it up even in his cruiser. Most of the cruisers are equipped with tablets now. They can punch in information right at the cruiser, and through modems he's able to search the database. The old days, we used to have what we call a pizza oven in here, so to check records, it looked like a pizza oven. You'd go to the records room and push a button, and you'd have to, by hand, go through records to find these things.
Wow. I remember one of the class reunions talking to Don Kennefic, who's recently retired as a state policeman, and he said, Josh, you'd be out there at 2 o'clock in the morning and feel like you're the only other person on the road besides the one you just pulled over. But if you say officer needs assistance, they come out of nowhere. And in a matter of minutes, you've got all the backup you need. What are kinds of situations that come up that people would call for a backup, or you'll see, you're driving by the rotary and the car's pulled over, but there's two or three police cars there? What are some kinds of things that might be going on when we see that?
Well, it could be any type of crime, depending on who the individual is. If it's a drug dealer that we know is coming into town, obviously we'd have two or three cars, respond to that call. Domestic violence scenes takes numerous officers, multiple officers to handle a domestic violence scene. mental health issues. A lot of times it takes multiple offices. Anybody that's violent or combative would take multiple units. So those are all types of calls that would require more than one police officer to respond.
I'm told I talk frequently with a gentleman who's in his 80s. He lives down on the South Shore, but grew up in Gloucester and knows Gloucester better than anybody, it seems. But he told me that in the old days they had and the building still exists, but there was a place down in Lanesville where they would lock people up, and if somebody was if they needed to arrest somebody in Lanesville, they put them in this cell in some building that's still present, apparently, and they would just send the wagon down the next day to pick them up and bring them back to the local police station.
Yeah, I've heard that story myself, and someone told me that in a cellar down there, that little cell still exists. I've seen it.
I haven't, but that'll be on the list. What are the major issues and crimes that you and your force find yourself dealing with for Gloucester? I know what we see in the paper, and I'm not sure if that's everything or that's just, you know, what gets processed on the front desk blotter or how that all plays out, but in Boston or some of the bigger cities, you have murders, you have kidnappings, you have more heinous crimes, and it doesn't seem like that stuff happens here, or we don't see it that much. Am I right there, or are there other things happening but we just don't see it?
No, everything that that happens here, obviously, we have a press log that goes out every day, so we're pretty open with anything that we're dealing with. You wouldn't hear about, maybe some of the sexual assault type cases wouldn't be available to the newspaper, that type of thing. Okay. But for the most part, everything you read in the newspaper is pretty much what we give out, what happens here. We do have those type of crimes, but they're the exception and not the rule. They do happen every several years, or I don't even remember the last time we had a murder. I'm guessing it was upwards of 10 years ago. So they do happen, but not very frequently here in Gloucester. We do handle a lot of, unfortunately, we handle a lot of domestic violence cases here in Gloucester. We handle, some drug dealing cases. We handle a lot of traffic cases here in Gloucester. Gloucester's a busy little city. It really is. It's small, but it's busy. And we handle probably 22,000 calls a year for service, which ranks up there with some of the higher cities our size.
Wow, that's commendable. Now, Mike Lane was a guest of somebody's at Rotary one day when he was the chief in Gloucester, and as a sidebar comment, he said, when we were growing up as kids, if kids were drinking down at Long Beach or Good Harbor Beach or Wingasheet or whatever, police would come down and, maybe confiscate the beer or tell everybody to go home. And that was one thing. Today with cell phones, before the cruiser can get to the pillars at Wingasheet Beach, the kids are already left.
Well, cell phones are a double-edged sword. They can be very good for us and very bad for us. The example you just cited would probably be the thing that hinder us a little bit. But on the most part, cell phones have been very productive in police and law enforcement. It gives the public an eye and the ability to alert us to situations.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. When you bring in somebody for questioning, if they have a cell phone, how does that work? Can you look at the cell phone and see whose names are on it? Or
no, we'd need a warrant to look at the cell phone, and we'd need probable cause to get the warrant. So that does happen. We do ask for warrants for cell phones. It's typically in a drug dealing type case, that type of a thing.
Yeah. What What have been the challenges for you as police chief here in Gloucester?
Well, I don't know. I'd call them challenges, but we stay pretty busy. When I became chief, I was given a mandate by the mayor that she wanted the department to be more community oriented, more community policing done, and we've kind of taken that on as our challenge. And we've got several programs that we've launched in regards to community policing. The most recent being the Cops and Kids, where our officers go into the K-5 schools, the five schools, and have lunch with the students, serve them lunch, maybe play with them out at recess, just to try to get the children at an early age to be comfortable with police officers.
That's great. And what are some of the other programs that you are working on or have introduced since you started?
You're going to see more foot patrol. We're going to have people out interacting with the public, especially on like Main Street and the Boulevard area, when personnel are available. And we've already seen it. As soon as we had the weather hit where it was good, we've been telling, our officers inside. We have 2-911 and a house officer inside. We've been telling the house officer, go out and walk Main Street. Talk to the store owner, see what their problems are, see if there are any issues. Policing's becoming more, over my career, it's not reactionary. It's going out, at least this is our approach, going out and trying to solve problems before they happen.
My grandfather was a sergeant and lieutenant in the Gloucester Police Force back in the rum-running days, but the story is told that he was walking the beat in East Gloucester when they saw some lights flickering in the studios of the Hawthorne. And so he went and he kicked in one of the doors, and an arson had set candles in barrels of kerosene so that they'd blow up and the place would burn, and the hotel owner had rented a room in Boston to watch the place burn up. But so he ran back to the box and they were able to avert the fire. But I mean, that was the old days when you didn't have lots of police cruisers and other kinds of vehicles and so forth. But it seems logical reinitiating the foot patrols would bring a lot of good attention to police work as well as the community.
Exactly. And, it's getting out and talking to people. It's interacting with people. It's letting them know their police department. I mean, there's nothing that's going to replace, the patrol units. Obviously, when we have emergencies, they can get to a call very quickly. The newer cars are all the new interceptors where they're all-wheel drive. They can get around. I can remember having to go to DPW and having chains put on the old cars, and now we have everything that's four-wheel drive. We have some trucks. So the equipment has come a long way. However, with that, we've separated ourselves from the communicating with the public, and that's something that's important to me, that we get our guys out there and talking to the public.
Well, when Peter Hickey was the square man, as they used to call him, or had the Main Street beat, there were no pickpockets or nobody could shoplift that he wouldn't pick them up. he was whatever innate ability one needs to have, but he instantly could focus on a person. He could be talking to you, but he could be looking across the street, and he just, wait a minute, I got to go.
And Peter was a good cop. Peter did a lot of good police work. I worked with Pete for several years when I came on.
Yeah.
And in his later years, he actually went into a police cruiser, But
yeah.
You're right. When I first started, he was on the beat.
Yeah. What's changed for you as police chief? You were the first assistant police chief, a position we apparently needed. And fortunate for us, you were in that position because you brought 36 years of experience into the chief's position with you now. So you know the community, you're one of us for good or for bad. Going from the assistant to the chief, what's changed for you, if anything?
Well, you know, I did quite a bit when I was assistant chief that I'm doing now. However, the communications, the emails, the meetings, it's just, it's obviously increased greatly.
Sure.
I probably get 100 emails a day. It's just, it's challenging just to keep up with emails. But, you know, something, we have a lot of good people here. We have a lot of good young police officers. And a lot of people are pitching in and helping. And you know, something, you're only as good as the people that work with you. And we have great people working here. So I'm very lucky in that regard.
Well, that's great. You know, that was one of the first things I remember hearing you say as a police chief, is one of your first comments were talking about all the good the folks in law enforcement do locally. And I've learned from the different engagements I've had, both paid and volunteer, you can't say enough good things about the efforts that people do. And it goes a long way, I think, to improving the morale or helping the morale, and it lets people know that you care and that you're watching what they're doing, but not in a critical way, but you're there as a resource to help them.
Right, and you know something, that is our philosophy. You know something, our supervisors are there to work for the patrol force, because the backbone of any organization, any police department, is, you know, the rank and file patrolmen. You know, they're the ones that are doing most of the work, and our job is to make sure that they have the tools they need to do the work.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Certainly wish you the very best and the greatest success as you continue to lead law enforcement here in Gloucester.
Thanks for having me on, Josh.
Thank you, John. Bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
NSONewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players, exclusive video interviews following the big games, live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball, live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders, mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Genevieve Knave. Genevieve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, we had you on for a little bit, but we're going to have to start again from scratch this week. But so tell us, give us your bio, your 3 or 4 minute or however long you want to go, and tell us about your background, education, experience, and so forth.
Sure. Okay, so my background is definitely in the body-mind integration part of my work. So I have a bachelor's degree in neuroscience that I got at Smith College, and I really got interested in the body-mind interface then. And I worked in basic research for a little bit after that at the Harvard Teaching Hospitals, published a little bit of research on sleep, and really just got really interested in the body. So I got my master's at Lesley University after that in dance movement therapy, which is one of the expressive arts therapies that really emphasizes the body and the mind working together for recovery, and particularly using our body to express ourselves and not always just using words to express ourselves. So I've been working in the field of trauma and addiction, two of the most important places where we need the body-mind together, for a while now. I have always worked in Boston. I'm originally from the city of Boston, so I've tried to really keep my work local. I worked at the South Boston Collaborative, where I got a lot of my training, which is a substance abuse clinic in my hometown. And I got training through the International Trauma Center, which is also in South Boston, that works mostly with children. I did my supervised work like right after grad school at South Bay Mental Health in Dorchester, and now I have a private practice in South Boston, so I've really kept it pretty local.
Great. Tell us about your private practice now, and how does that work? What are the range of patients that you treat, and how that's going?
Okay, sure. So I see mostly adults. I've had a couple of teenagers, but I mostly do adult work, and I treat people primarily for trauma and for compulsive disorders like addiction. And I really approach addiction looking at the obsession and looking at the compulsive behavior, right? So people can come to me, they can come to me for individual therapy where I really, really try to individualize the care. So they might end up doing dance movement therapy. They might end up not being ready for that, just doing basic talk therapy. And I really try to do something that's really specific for the person. We also offer peer recovery supports for people in sobriety. So we have a recovery coach on our staff, and he does a lot of stuff that actually does also integrate the body, but not so much in a strictly therapy way. So he has a program called Sports for Supports, and he does like sober basketball leagues and stuff like that with people. He can take people to 12-step meetings. He's really trying to work with younger people too, to get them to fun in their new sober life. So people could come and they could see me and him. Some people have come and really not wanted to do therapy yet, but have wanted to work with him. So that's who I would see for substance use. I also get some family work. People come to me for family conflicts. I get some parents and children. I do a program for young children, like ages 1 to 3, and parents that's developed by the International Trauma Center. It's called Rainbow Dance, and it's an attunement movement program. So we do the same movement structure every week, and it develops a lot of attunement, healthy attachment, communication. And some people just come to that as like an enrichment, as if it's the dance class, and they just get the benefit of it. And some people come more specifically because maybe they are looking to, have their child have more self-regulation. Maybe they think their child's really hyper or something.
Great. You mentioned that you did some research and maybe published some things about sleep. Tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
Sure. Okay, so I worked at the Cognition and Action Lab in Amherst while I was studying neuroscience out there, and I looked at the type of behavior that is actually, related to disorders like OCD and addiction. So, how many times am I going to do the same behavior and not really get a reward for it, right? But just keep doing the behavior that might end up being harmful. And I used a test called the Iowa Gambling Task, which is what it sounds like. It's like a computer card game. And there's, if you keep doing this reward behavior that you could kind of picture being pretty associated with addiction, going for like the big money really fast, but you end up losing more. There's a trick to the card game. And if you can kind of delay your gratification, you'll win the card game. And if you can't, you'll lose the card game. And so we would see how many people did better on this test when they had taken it the first time, slept through the night, and then taken it the second time, versus taking it the first time, gone through their day without sleeping, and then taken it the second time at night. And as you would kind of suspect, the people who slept really consolidated the information much better in their minds, were able to integrate it, and did much better.
What are some of the, if you know this or if you cover this, what are some of the kinds of challenges people have who are sleep deprived?
Oh, many. Right.
Okay.
So one of them that we just talked about, right, like our affect-guided decision-making, so how I feel, am I going to be stressed out and tired and then make a poor decision from it? That's what my research was on. It was actually called affect-guided decision-making. So how does my mood affect my decisions? It's going to not be as great if I don't have enough sleep, right, because I'm not able to really have my judgment fully intact if I don't have enough sleep. There's so much that we don't know about sleep yet, too, but the benefits of sleep, we do know. So the benefits of sleep on memory are one of the best things that we know, which is that if I am trying to remember something and I don't get enough sleep, I might remember it as if it's a movie that I saw out of order, is the best way I can describe that. So I can't really organize my thoughts and memories as well to access information that I need, which, as you can guess, probably also goes into decision-making, right? If I can't access the information about past experiences or that I'm trying to recall in an organized way, I can't really use it to make better decisions the next time, and sleep deprivation disorganizes those memories.
Wow, that's interesting. Wow, that's fascinating. So, okay, and what are some of the other things that you studied or researched when you were in that phase of your education?
That was my big research project, and then I worked at Mass General looking at oxygenation in babies' brains, and I worked under a woman, Dr. Franceschini at Mass General, who she actually developed an infrared spectroscopy light. So babies' brains are underneath such a thin skull that she could use this light and look at the oxygen in their brains. And we learn so much about babies when they're born, right? Like, we get vitals, we get all this stuff, and we weren't really looking at their brains a lot. So her big goal was really to make that be just a regular thing that happened. And so I worked with her on just testing out this instrument that she made and really using it to take those measurements. So I was kind of the person that did the pilot study for that with her. And I think, you know, brain health is really, really important and definitely undervalued in newborns. So that was another thing that I did.
This is Rick Moore, Genevieve. How do I pronounce your first name?
Genevieve.
Okay. I'm a co-host with Josh. And, you know, I was wondering about the dance movement thing. I'm not particularly touchy-feely. And I went to a couples yoga class with my wife recently. And I was fascinated by it. It was just amazing to me. And can you relate maybe a success story about or something that surprised you in a positive way about the dance movement thing with maybe an individual? Obviously, you don't mention names, but tell me a little bit about how that works and how someone might benefit from that. And again, if you have a success story you can relate, that'd be cool.
Absolutely. Okay, so you talked about not being touchy-feely, which I love, because dance movement therapy was actually started after World War II with a lot of military people who had really bad trauma, and they couldn't really talk because they were, you know, quote-unquote shell-shocked. And so obviously they weren't very touchy-feely either, right? So I think often when we think about the expressive arts, we think of, like, hippies who are totally open to therapy or whatever, right? And
yep.
Modality was actually developed for people who were pretty much just the opposite. It was like they were so paralyzed by their trauma that they couldn't do traditional talk therapy. So this woman, Marion Chase, started doing group therapy just using movement, and that's how it developed. And my big success story that stands out was actually also with somebody from the military who was so traumatized. He couldn't really make eye contact. He couldn't. His posture was just really poor. He didn't speak a lot, and I really got through to him using the expressive arts. It was one of my first cases when I was pretty young, and we ended up doing a waltzing series that really helped him kind of stand up straight, make eye contact, connect, develop attunement. And that's like my coolest one. I can't even believe it happened. When I talk about it, I still get so excited because it was really, really hard to reach him, so we ended up going such interesting places, and he made great, great progress. And he used a lot of visual art, too. But the waltzing was really wonderful because of just the way that it allowed him to connect and to attune. Because when I first met him, he was not, you know, having, like, appropriate facial expressions for the situation, just not attuning, not responding appropriately. And that's really what got him to connect. And I'm glad that you talked about couples yoga, because yoga now is so mainstream. Way that we can get people into their bodies to start out before they're ready to maybe use movement for expression. So we offer an acro yoga class for couples for trust building communication, and it's a great entryway.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And I'm very happy to hear that about your success story, because when you said waltz, it brings a smile to my face. In Gloucester, there's the fifth graders have something called the Mad Hot Ball, and I learned how to waltz with my fifth grade daughter quite a few years ago. So you hit home.
Great, great. So, how does somebody find out about you, and how does what would a typical intake be for you, if there is such a thing, how does that work?
Sure. So a lot of people find out about me through word of mouth, because, like I said, I have been working in my own community for a long time, so a lot of people kind of know who I am with when something with addiction or trauma specifically come up. I also have a website, I have a Facebook page. I don't do a ton of advertising because I do get a lot of word of mouth referrals. And a typical intake, so we do our initial assessment. It's always free because it's, you know, to decide whether we're the appropriate service for the person. So I do a basic diagnostic evaluation, biopsychosocial evaluation, and I really look at the person's needs. And, you know, sometimes people come and they really just want to do our yoga class, and then they just come. They don't need a diagnostic evaluation for that. Or sometimes people come and they say that they want couples work. And, you know, I just look at if somebody has issues that I specifically address, I always keep them. If I think that, you know, I know a different specialist in the area who would be better for their specific needs, I always refer out, right? Because if I have a foot problem, I want to go to a foot doctor. I don't want to go to, like, a skin doctor. So I really try to make sure that I keep my specialization.
Good. Great. So some of the what led you from the neurological, what was the migration from studying neuroscience to dance movement? And
sure. Mm-hmm. Great question. So I was a neuroscience dance double major in undergrad,
okay.
And I always wanted to see some studies on the neurological benefits of dance and movement, because I see so much research about yoga, I see so much research about sports, but I really wanted to do more research about the creative process. So I ended up getting my master's in dance movement therapy kind of with that aim in mind, thinking that I would, you know, learn about it and go do research about it, and then I would, you know, keep doing research. But when I was in the process of going through my master's and having internships, I just realized that I really wanted to be in the work and doing the work as opposed to just studying it. So, I mean, I think that I probably will do some more, like, cognitively based research later, but right now I just love practicing so much.
How does somebody how do you know, maybe not a fair question, in terms of assigning or figuring out what type of movement or what type of movement issues relate to a person's neurological challenge? How do you, you know, are there some things that are more, you do more for a certain type of challenge versus something else, or is it really vary person to person?
It's definitely very person to person. I think that one of the big things individualized, but, you know, pretty common among many individuals the same issues is just not feeling embodied at all, right? So not having awareness of our bodies. Like in trauma, we have dissociation. In addiction, we're poisoning our body. So there's this separation from the body. So just becoming safely embodied and feeling in the body is a big, big starting point. So it's not that there are movement issues. I mean, sometimes there are, but it wouldn't be movement issues per se. It would just be this kind of lack of body awareness, lack of feeling embodied.
Do you sense, or did you discover at all, or had you, in the context of your research and your work, is it your opinion at all that that some types of behavior, be it addiction, OCD, or what have you, are people are genetically predisposed to?
Yes, I believe that. Yes.
Okay.
I did a lot of research on epigenetics, too. I forgot to tell you that. And I did. I studied it at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. And we looked at potato plants. So epigenetics is, it's not difference in genes, period, but it's you might have the same gene, but it expresses itself differently. And that's really where I think the information about alcoholism being genetic lies, right? Because if three different people, you know, say try heroin, right? Not all of us are going to go and get completely addicted to it, right? You see people who get opiates for surgeries and they might have a physical addiction to it, but then they can stop it and they can be okay. But that psychological trigger, an obsession, right? That's why I always compare to OCD. That obsession with the substance is, that's not the same across all people. And I definitely, definitely think that there is a genetic component to that.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, thank you. I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and wish you continued success in your career and with your wellness and therapy company organization in Boston.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Genevieve.
Have a good day. Bye.
Come in, take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan, plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Hi, this is Saka Sarkisian, owner of Sarkisian Sportswear, located on Route 1 South in Peabody. We are a sports team dealer and custom apparel distributor that can handle all of your team's or company's uniform and apparel needs. So stop by and visit us at 182 Newbury Street in Peabody to see our storefront. Visit with our friendly and helpful staff and let us help you get the right fit for your program. Also, you can visit our website, SarkisianSports.com, to view our monthly specials and learn more about us.
Hi folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson 400 series windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Anderson 400 is attractive, durable, energy efficient, and reasonably priced. Remember, Anderson is the most trusted name in windows. See the Anderson 400 at any of our three locations. That's North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is not a stranger to us. She's been on our show last year, and then more recently was interviewed by Rick Moore on the Boulevard yesterday, I believe. Susan Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh.
Now, you're the coordinator for the Generous Gardeners program. Is that, do I have the title right?
Well, it's not really a program. We're a nonprofit organization that's just a group of volunteer gardeners. We're nonprofits, so that people can give us tax-deductible donations, but we don't get, you know, we're all just volunteers. We don't have an executive director. No one gets paid. And our mission is beautification of Gloucester through gardens. And we're now taking care of 25 spaces, traffic islands, the library behind the police station, and now the crown jewel, which is the Boulevard Gardens.
That's great. And they look terrific. I mean, I've seen the different spots around and commented to whoever was in the car that that's what Susan Kelly's doing in her group.
Yeah, my group. It's not just me. I have a lot of very, very energetic and active volunteers. I mean, I couldn't do any of this without a lot of people who have the same kind of dedication to making Gloucester beautiful and, you know, clean. And, you know, there's so many people with great intentions in our community.
So I'm going to backtrack just for a second. Can you give us your, for those who didn't have the benefit of listening to you when we had you on last spring or early summer, give us your bio, your background, and tell us about you, and then talk about maybe how you came into this organization, how that developed, and what was the thinking, and how did you manage to get people to rally around and want to do this?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll try to make it quick and easy. But five years ago, actually, my real job is I run a software company, a technology company, but I also am an incredibly dedicated gardener, and I was always trying to figure out how to combine the two. And a friend of mine and I, Therese O'Connell, who's a master gardener, and she and I have been brainstorming for years trying to figure out some gardening thing that would get me out of airplanes and get her, anyway. So we decided we were going to build this website for plant swapping, and it didn't work out. People just didn't list anything, so that kind of bombed. But that was kind of how it all started. We were trying to teach people that they have value in their flowers in their garden. Flowers like to be divided. A lot of flowers give off, seedlings, and a lot of them really benefit from being divided, and those can be given away or sold or donated, and everybody's gardens can become more and more and more beautiful without necessarily buying a lot of plants. So that was kind of our idea, and we started by having plant sales for the Gloucester Education Foundation and started the whole plant program, because they were giving kind of scholarships to the teachers for plant-related things. And then I was asked to become the city planting, get on the city planting committee, which is a volunteer official position. You're appointed. And so it was in that capacity that I kind of started. I'm one of those people, if I see something that needs to be done, I just do it. And I could see lots and lots of gardens in Gloucester that public spaces, traffic islands, that needed to be done. The police station was kind of my first real big installation, and that happened when, at the time, Chief Campanella called me and said, "Are you the planting lady?" And they had just put that big, long dirt embankment up and, finally gotten rid of the hazard tape and the stairs. And they asked me to plant it, and I said, "Is there a budget?" And the answer was no. So I said, "Okay, I've got lots of daisies and daylilies and ornamental grasses, and I'll do what I can." And he said, "Oh, can we have blue flowers? Because we're the police." So we dedicated that river of blue that goes down on the left, and then we did the river of daisies. And now, right now, there's a river of daffodils blooming, but it ended up turning out really, really nice. And then the next year, the DPW cleaned up the left side, and basically, it's kind of evolved. We cleaned out all the beds around the American Legion, and we planted there tons of daylilies and irises that we had to move from Boulevard when the fence went up, when they started doing that project down there. So I've been very involved in all of these public spaces. And so 3 years ago, when they were finalizing the contract for the seawall improvements, Mike Hale from the DPW reached out to me and said, "Would you guys like more gardens on the boulevard?" I was like, "Absolutely." So that's when one of my volunteers is Ann Johnson, who actually designed the Fisherman Wives Plaza. And she's a retired landscape architect, but she took all of her materials out of storage and came up with three concept drawings. And the one that you see that's been implemented was the one that was unanimously chosen by the Fisherman Wives, the DPW, and the mayor's office. And this all happened 3 years ago, and it's just amazing to me to go down there and walk among those beds, and it just looks so beautiful, and that it happened. It's pretty remarkable.
That's great. And tell us about the software company that you run.
Oh, my software company is called MicroSearch Corporation. We're in Saugus. We're a very small company, but my husband and I started it 24 years ago, and we build big searchable document databases, mostly for labor unions. So we have almost every teacher contract and public sector contract in our databases for our clients.
What is the product and who buys it?
It's a portal. It's a research portal search engine. We actually had a search engine before Google existed. So okay. We were a DOS-based search engine for documents, and so we just kind of morphed into a web-based. We're a software as a services company, so people basically give us their content, and we build them a secure research portal where they can search for their content in a secure environment that they own the content, but we host and maintain it.
So just so that I understand, so you're the city of Gloucester, and you're saying, okay, we have the teacher's contract or the police contract coming up.
No, it's the other way around. We would be the one, like, let's say. AFSCME is one of the biggest public sector unions. They're a client of mine, so they have thousands of contracts, including some, or like the Gloucester Teachers contract. We work for the Mass Teachers Association, so we have a database of all the contracts of every
city in Massachusetts. So it's just available for kind of the union side.
Oh, the unions. Okay. So, all right. So the unions use your services to create a better bargaining unit position when they're going to the table.
Right, exactly. So they know, they can, you know, search and find and compare and do things like that. So so that's kind of been my niche for many, many years, and it's a great niche to be in. And it in the summertime, I, you know, take a fair amount of time off to do the gardening. But I want to make for the record, I did have to resign as the chair of the city planting committee in order to fundraise for the boulevard. So I am no longer have any official capacity in the city. There's just, under the state ethics law, you're not allowed to fundraise if you're a city employee. So even a volunteer. So I'm not in that capacity anymore. I'm just Generous Gardeners. And so that, just want to make that clear.
That's great. And what are some of the events that you have coming up for Generous Gardeners?
Okay, well, tomorrow, Saturday, rain or shine, is the official Tulip Festival. It's the grand opening of the Boulevard Gardens and the Seawall Reconstruction Project. And we thought that would be fun to do kind of old-fashioned promenade. So dress in your finest and come stroll with us from the Visitor Center down Hoe Avenue to the Boulevard, and then we have a tent set up next to the Fisherman Wives, and we have three judges, the mayor, Safafia Fakin, and William Taylor, who is the Grand Marshal and one of the major visionaries about the idea of having gardens along the Boulevard, and Heidi Dallin from the Gloucester Stage Company will be our judges. So basically we're going to kind of do a little 15-minute stroll down, and then the mayor will give a little speech, and we'll do a ribbon cutting, and the gardens will be officially open. But of course, they've been open for a week, and everyone's really been enjoying the tulips.
Okay, and what about fundraising and other activities that are coming up?
Okay, well, yes, we do fundraise, as you can imagine. It does, you know, tulips are not free, neither of the flowers. We're planning on putting perennials and annuals in when the tulips are done blooming. But we have a couple things going on. The Tulip Festival party tomorrow night will be at the Mile Marker. There's a big tent there. It's $20 for cash bar and appetizers, and the Honky Tonk Women's Band will be playing for us. We have a raffle for an $8,500 all-inclusive trip for two to Amsterdam for the third week of April 2018. It's a very high-end tour company called Luffner, and we're actually buying the trip, and then we're selling 200 $100 raffle tickets. That's a very big fundraiser for us. And then our main way we make money is the Gloucester Garden Tour, which is July 8th. And then we have an amazing garden tour in Magnolia this year. We move it around different parts of Gloucester each year. Last year was Eastern Point. The year before it was Annisquam. Year before that it was Backshore. And the year before that it was West Gloucester. We've only been doing this for the last 5 years. So Generous Gardeners really kind of got started 5 years ago when we really got involved in the city. And we started the garden tour in order to raise money for the Fisherman Wives Memorial because they had no money for flowers. And so that kind of started the whole ball rolling for Generous Gardeners in terms of public service.
So when you have a garden tour like Eastern Point, how does that work? Do you go out and recruit people who have really magnificent gardens?
Exactly. That's what we do. So the day after each garden tour, we start doing our little kind of sleuthing, trespassing, you know, kind of peeking over fences and poking around to see, you know, who has amazing gardens that will be blooming, you know, in early July. And then we start knocking on doors and sending letters and begging and, you know, explaining what a great cause it is. And, you know, people are very generous, very, very generous. We have a lot of people and they will open up their gardens. And so we charge $30 for a ticket for the day, or, you know, for the tour. And you basically, it's a self-guided tour anytime between 10 and 4 on July 8th. We'll be selling the tickets out of the Magnolia Library, or you can buy them online in advance at GloucesterGardenTour.org. But you can also just come the day of. And again, it's a self-guided tour, so anytime between 10 and 4, you can come. You know, it's a 1.5-mile walk, so it's just a lovely walk along Shore Road in Magnolia. And you know, it's really a beautiful way to spend, you know, a summer day.
I tell you a cute story. When my father was a landscape gardener and had Mount Pleasant Gardens and had a number of accounts and estates, some of the estates on Eastern Point, and we went to visit the Saunders estate, which is next to down Pier Lane on the other side of the Jacobs estate, and talking to Mrs. Saunders and Mrs. Saunders, I think, at the time, and said, you know, he remembered what the place looked like two or three owners ago, because he, you know, grew up in East Gloucester, and he said a lot of really nice trees and plants, and, you know, it would take a while, we could bring it back, and he came back out to the truck, and I said, Dad, wouldn't it be easy to get a couple sticks of dynamite and just blow the place and start from scratch? And he looked at me like, are you my son? Kind of look. They have a swimming pool that's down right by the beach there, and they did not want to bother the large pine trees in the yard, so I dug the trench for the electrical conduit to hook up the jacuzzi by hand. college. So
beautiful. That house was not on our tour last year, but we did have some amazing homes. You know, some of these gated estates, they opened up their doors for the public for a day. And
beautiful places down there.
Quite spectacular.
My father actually worked at the Ramparts when he was a kid growing up.
Oh, okay.
When the Raymond's house was all intact, and when the water towers were in full state of construction. I mean, they actually work, and they weren't just the remnants of what's there now. But,
wow.
Well, I want to thank you for being a guest, and wish you certainly the very best of success. I have to say that Gloucester looks so much better with the gardens and the work and the efforts of you and your crew of volunteers. And if people want to take a chance on the trip to Amsterdam, or they just want to contribute in some way, how do they do that?
Okay, they can just send a check to Generous Gardeners, P.O. Box 1532, Gloucester, Mass., 01930 and 01931 for P.O. Boxes. And we are a nonprofit, so it's fully tax deductible. Although the raffle tickets technically are not tax deductible because you are buying a chance. So we've kind of gone back and forth about that and looked online, and it seems like it should be tax deductible. But anyway, not completely.
It's between you and your accountant, I guess, right?
Right, exactly. Between you and your accountant.
And the website for your organization
is generousgardeners.org. It was actually printed, I was able to redirect the .com to .org, but in the newspaper the other day they printed .com. But yeah, it's generousgardeners.org.
Great. Well, thank you again, and good luck with your promenade tomorrow and all of the plantings and tours that you have coming up.
To bring umbrellas.
Okay. Take care. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
MSO NewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players. Exclusive video interviews following the big games. Live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. Live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders, mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
All right, so that just about takes care of Trending Now for this week. A very interesting program there. Mr. Ryan, the dance thing fascinates me, the dance therapy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's sort of like what's been discovered with animal therapy as well, when, you know, kids can ride horses or you know, there are, what do they call them, working animals as well,
yeah.
You know. Tremendous stuff, and good stuff. So what do we got in the not-too-distant future here?
Deborah Gardner-Walker is a fundraising and public relations expert on the North Shore. She's going to be one of our guests next week. Kim Kerrigan, a radio person from WRKO, is going to be on next week. Following week, we have Elena Backrack, is the executive director of the Newburyport Art Association, will be one of our guests, as will Bob Gillis, the new president of the Cape Ann Savings Bank.
Wow. All right. That's an eclectic group. Sounds great. Awesome. Awesome job. Thank you. I don't know about tomorrow. Tomorrow is Kentucky Derby Day as well, so you're supposed to wear one of those big, great, big bonnets, you know? And I think that's what the mayor's going to have on the boulevard tomorrow, but it's going to be a stormy day, so I don't know if
Manchester,
that's
going to work. Manchester Essex Rotary Club is having a night at the Kentucky Derby night at their Elks Hall in Manchester. So if you want to go out and enjoy a good time, you might want to take that in.
Okay, have a good day. Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, I'm Rick Moore. Have a great weekend.